Invisible Illness. For the purpose of this podcast, this term will encompass hidden mental and physical conditions.
We're Freya and Liv, students at the University of Nottingham, and in each episode, we will be exploring the impact these invisible conditions can have.
That's why this episode, we talked to Harry about his experience with a long-term chronic health condition.
Just a heads up, some people might find some of the things we discuss here uncomfortable.
If you need it, there will be useful contact details in the description below.
So Harry, a quick Google search of the term invisible illness comes up with a number of definitions. What do you think of the definition that we've come up with for this podcast?
Yeah, I think definitely the definition that you both gave works. I think for me, though, it kind of goes beyond the definition in terms of what it's taught me, and kind of that's the meaning that the term has to me, is kind of a lesson of what I really, you know, learned from this experience. And what I learned was that, you know, I think I used to assert strength with just kind of physical dominance and the ability to be strong, and I never stopped to consider that there are really loads of different types of being strong. And I think that it really allowed me to respect people who, when I heard what they had gone through, you know, respect that even though they may not look, you know, physically strong, that actually every person kind of on their own is going through some sort of battle. And I think people go to tremendous amounts to try and win that battle. And for some people, that kind of particular struggle never really ends. I think that's a really, yeah, I think that for me is the kind of best type of being strong, really. It's that strength within that I don't think, you know, like my illness is shown. But, and though I don't want to kind of harp on about my own particular struggle, but definitely from hearing other people, and, you know, this goes from just beyond invisible illness, but, you know, people who struggle with other things as well, personal trauma. The strength that they must display in order to get up every day is something that we don't see, just like we don't see invisible illness. So yeah, back in November 2015, I was diagnosed with a long-term chronic health condition, and it started in the September of that year, where I went to the doctor because I was quite concerned about a low BMI and kind of weight loss and stuff like that, and I wanted to know if there was anything potentially wrong with me or anything that I was doing that I shouldn't be doing or anything that I could do to kind of help. And the doctor asked me a couple of questions and then kind of told me to book another appointment and to told me to look out for certain symptoms as well. And then literally after, like maybe the day after that appointment, suddenly I started noticing all the things she was talking about, and they included things like kind of more fatigue, more kind of the bits of pain in my gut as well, and yeah, basically kind of other symptoms associated with it, like irritability and stuff like that. And so I went back to the doctor, and they then referred me to a specialist who was quite a bit out of town, quite a bit out of Nottingham. And because of the way specialism works, well, like you have to wait ages to get referred. And I think that was one of the problems throughout this, is that often it gets to the point where you need really quite urgent medical care, and the places like A&E that are designed for that aren't designed for your type of urgent care, and then the referral and the specialist people, you know, they will take ages to be seen because of, you know, they have, you know, loads of stuff booked up, I imagine. And so yeah, my symptoms started deteriorating, but I was still waiting for this operation which would hopefully fully diagnose me. And it was getting pretty bad, so, you know, I was trying to keep on going to my lectures and stuff, but it wasn't really working out that well. I'd have to duck out of classrooms and seminars, and kind of people I knew were just kind of wondering why this guy was like leaving with no explanation, because of the pain that I was in. And then often as well, my friends would kind of say, let's do this, and I'd either have to leave early or I'd only be able to do an hour of it. I felt too embarrassed, or kind of, I didn't really know what to tell them because I hadn't been diagnosed, you know, there was no like oh, I've got this, and therefore, you know, that's what I will need to be doing from now on. It was just like, I'm in this horrible situation, and I don't know what it is, and I don't know why it's happening to me. I was thinking, like, you know, is this just, you know, 1 in 100,000 people kind of thing, or is it like something that I, you know, a particular vice or something that I indulged in that was getting me in this way? And then about a week before the diagnosis, I went to see the doctor for like the pre, kind of maybe screening is what they call it, where basically they walk you through what the operation will involve. They gave me this stuff that I had to take as well to before the operation, and then they were like, they basically told me that what I had, they were pretty sure that this was before the screening, was because of my immune system was way too high. Like, it would attack bacteria that was normally harmless and make it and cause kind of internal, like, it would attack my own cells as well. And you know, it's pretty severe, you know, when your immune system targets something that shouldn't be there. So it can cause a lot of like internal pain. And then they told me, however, that this could be that my symptoms matched quite a wide variety of stuff. You know, it's like if you Google your symptoms, it's going to be like, oh, you have a headache or cancer. Yeah. And for me, it was like, you're on this spectrum of possible things. At the one side, the answer will be a bit of treatment, maybe, you know, some pills to take for a couple of months. And on the other side was actually cancer. And for me, just kind of on my own, in a house with people that maybe I felt weren't really the people I'd want to tell about this kind of stuff. You know, I think it does take quite a special person in your life to be able to confide stuff like this to. And with your family, it's like, it's not that you don't want to worry them, it's just that I wanted to go to them with concrete information and not have my mum calling me every day saying, I found this that, you know, maybe, you know, if you do this, it'll go away. And it's like, when you know that's not the case. So I was just kind of sitting there by myself thinking about how I remember it being on the Thursday, the operation. If I, you know, came out of that operation, they told me that, you know, you have X amount of months to live or whatever, kind of what a life kind of changing moment would be. And then you start doing stupid things like thinking, what would my obituary read? Yeah, how would I spend my last 6 months? And you know, that's not a rabbit hole you want to go into by any means.
So something that I found quite interesting about what Harry was initially saying about before he was diagnosed with the condition was the fact that it was something that was
progressively getting worse.
Yeah, something that was already affecting him, I think.
And that's something that gets worse without you realising.
And also that you don't necessarily notice the symptoms.
There's actually one study that shows that there are three kind of main reasons why people don't go and seek medical care, and one of those is that they don't see a need to. It was 12.2% who kind of hadn't realised that they needed to go to the doctor. They just kind of thought that it was something that would pass. However, 33.3% of the 1,369 people asked, which is over a third actually, their reason was that they reported unfavourable evaluations of seeking medical care, such as factors related to physicians, healthcare organisations and affective concerns, which I think is really...
And this is something Harry goes on to talk about later, which obviously will come up later on. Something that we also found, I think, is that there's a lot of issues concerning untreated chronic illnesses and things. Harry begins to talk about the fact that it was affecting his social life, his ability to do things, and complications because of these illnesses, especially when they're untreated. Something that causes people to miss work, causes people to miss social occasions and things like that, and then comes to affect mental health and things like that later on down the line.
Of course I was overreacting, but when it's kind of thrust upon you like that, it is hard to think about, you know, take a step back and be like, oh, it'll be fine, because you know things aren't fine. And so yeah, in the lead up to it as well, I had to like basically fast and like not eat anything, and by the time that I left the operation, and also I'd been put under like kind of sedatives and stuff. When they were telling me things like, this is what you have, here's how many pills you should take a day, I was both A, high, and B, like about to faint. So it wasn't really a good combination, and it meant that for the next couple of weeks, when my dad drove me home and then he drove home, I basically kind of misread the label on the bottle telling me how many pills I should take. And it wasn't like I was ODing or anything, but I basically didn't take enough. And by December, I had like a kind of, they termed it a nervous reaction, and basically something in the nerves in my stomach reacted with the hot water from the shower. And all my friends had gone home because they had, you know, it was Christmas while I was working over Christmas. And this was another thing, I was trying to fit in bar work around, you know, time, URN, all these things. I lost control of my body, and it just kind of chucks me out of the shower. I remember banging into the shower rack, falling on the floor while hitting my head on the sink, and then just passing out for 2 hours, because I knew no one's in the house, no one could help me. And then, I had to go to A&E, and they basically gave me an IV drip, and then I went home. And then I remembered the amount of medicine I had to take, and that immediately, literally within 2 weeks, I was back on my feet, I was feeling way better, and I thought, great, that's the end of it. You know, they gave me this long-term medication, which they told me would help, as well as the short-term medication, which helped in the immediacy of it. The diagnosis, I didn't feel that the doctor was very like sympathetic. I felt like he was going through the motions with me, and I was still only like, you know, 19 at the time, and kind of I'd never, you know, had to go to hospital that much before. And his he had quite like a strong accent as well, so often I'd have trouble understanding him. And then a lot of time with my condition, when you go to the doctor, they'll say, okay, can you lie on the bed, please? You lie on the bed, and then they basically proceed to poke you in the stomach for like 5 minutes, and when your condition is bad, that hurts like hell, and then you're trying to be like, ah, you know. And it's not fun, and it would have been nice to have a doctor who was a bit more maybe sympathetic and just kind of human about the whole process, you know, knowing that, okay, this operation might sound scary, but actually, yeah, this is going to be fine because XYZ, when all I got was, this is the operation you're having, be there this date, you know, make sure you do this, whatever. All in all, it kind of felt like I'd been entered into, it's basically, you know, like I was saying, it's on a spectrum, and I was kind of towards the rubbish end, but, you know, still not horrible. But yeah, it just kind of felt like they had handed me a raffle ticket and being like, there you go, yeah, you've won this pretty horrible condition that, you know, is completely random, we don't know how it starts, it just happens to occur in the ages of 18 to 21 for men, that's normally where it first flares up, and you know, there's no way to cure it, and you're just gonna have to take medicine for the rest of your life. The problems from then weren't to do with my condition, they were from side effects of the drugs I was taking, which were mainly based around steroid treatment for lowering my immune system. And that meant that often I'd pick up colds more easily because my immune system was lowered in that way. And then as well, for some reason it caused like an acne flare up, which, you know, at the age of like 19 or 20 you're thinking like, why is this happening to me? Like, this is meant to happen when you're like 15, not 20. In a generation of people who feel fairly self-conscious about their image, it wasn't fantastic to be going around uni feeling like that. And I didn't know it was because of the medicine I was taking, I just assumed it was just me. And again, if they had told me about that, I would have known to at least expect it, could have got the, you know, like cream and stuff they eventually gave me for it, and it would have been fine. As well, I noticed my mood swings were getting way more. My friends would tell me it would be sometimes difficult to hang around with me because of the kind of severity in that. And I wouldn't be able to like remember or tell when I was being like that. And I know as well for my housemates, especially in my final year, that they would, I think at the end of it, they felt that it really changed our friendship really by the end. And obviously that wasn't something that I intended. I thought things were going fine. I was on this long-term medication. I was about to graduate, and a couple of months before that, I had a meeting with the specialist doctor, and basically every time I went to see the doctor would change, so I didn't feel like I'd established any kind of like connection with the person I was seeing. Yeah, they basically told me, okay, we're just going to up your medication a little bit because you say that occasionally your symptoms will just flare up a little bit, and they weren't causing me any problems at this point, but I just thought I should let them know. And they said, okay, we're just going to up the dosage and hopefully that'll be fine. And so I kind of took it, went my way, went on holiday for just like a weekend, and I noticed that things were on there were getting a little bit worse. And then by the time that I was graduating, I was getting to the point where I was worried where I wouldn't be able to graduate. And I was sat there in this restaurant we were eating at before the graduation ceremony, feeling in like both like incredibly clammy and also like my stomach was gonna like explode, and I just was really worried. And then suddenly it passed, and that's the thing, is that it's really unexpected, unpredictable. It's like when lecturers ask, oh, what can I do to help your condition, you're like, nothing. Like, you know, there's nothing that can help, in the sense that I can't tell you when it's gonna happen. It could literally affect me that I might wake up, you know, past my 9 a.m. lecture, not because of me being like, you know, going to bed late. I might go to bed perfectly on time, but I just, the fatigue will suddenly set in and I won't be able to stop that. And then basically, because I was registered in Nottingham and I was living in London, when it was really getting bad while I was living in London, I couldn't change my GP in time, because I was kind of thinking, yeah, by the time I changed my GP and got an appointment, I'll be back in Nottingham, you know. So I kept with it in Nottingham, and then I tried to book an earlier appointment with the specialist, but that was pretty hard. They could only do 31st of August, and by this time it was maybe early August, and I was doing really badly.
I thought it was really interesting about when Harry mentioned the NHS and about not necessarily its failings, but how it's not made this journey any easier.
His frustrations with the NHS, yes, especially, I think, is I think it's something that a lot of people who suffer with chronic conditions, or that's something that I found in the research that I've done, and even thinking about personal things, like there's someone I know who struggles with COPD, which is to do with like the lungs and the breathing and stuff, and even things like the amount of medication that he talks about. He has to pay for that every month, and that's incredibly expensive for people who didn't choose to have a chronic condition.
Yeah, there is some types of funding out there. There's a form you can fill out, I know, because I know someone that's filled it out before, and they've managed to get some reduced rates on the medication, but you still have to pay a certain amount. Well, I assume depending on your circumstances. The fact, though, that it's sometimes so difficult to find a specialist who knows about your condition and who can actually talk, like, has an educated, if you like, view of it, if you know, like, knows what the condition well and then can prescribe the right treatment, I think is really surprising. And is, in fact, the Department of Health in March 2004 announced that a specialist team would be set up at a demonstration site within each of the 28 strategic health authority areas. And even though, like, this is quite a while ago now, and I think it seems like there needs to be something else done, perhaps, to kind
this
of...
This was something that was... 2004 was, I mean, nearly 15 years ago.
Yeah,
now.
And perhaps that we need more specialists in... in more areas, perhaps.
This is the issue with chronic illnesses that Harry kind of talks about, I think, throughout the thing, is that this idea of specialisation, the idea that he's kind of stuck between A&E not being specialist enough and the specialists being so specialist that there's only a few of them and the appointments are really few and far between.
Yeah, and especially like waiting times and things like that. I think at one point Harry talks about how he was looking at facing a 3-week wait It was like the beginning of August, and he couldn't get an appointment until the end of August, at a time when he needed to be seen immediately.
And this is obviously something that affects people's work life and things like that, something he again goes into quite considerably. And I think it's difficult, especially when people are already dealing with stigma when it comes to chronic conditions and chronic illnesses, and then on top of stigma and not necessarily wanting to discuss it, you're then dealing with the fact that you're not receiving treatment because you're waiting for treatment, or you don't know what treatment's available, and all of this kind of thing. During the period of that we were researching this before we spoke to Harry, something that I found quite interesting, and I feel that Harry does touch on in certain points, was this idea that chronic conditions have so much more impact than your day-to-day feeling of well-being physically, and then it also has this mental toll that he goes on to talk about later, that we'll talk about later as well. But something that I think people don't really necessarily register is this kind of socioeconomic burden, if you like, of living with a chronic condition, especially things like chronic pain and stuff like that, where you're constantly, it's constantly in your mind, it's constantly there. It's estimated that people living with chronic conditions and chronic pain especially consult their doctor up to 5 times more frequently than other people. So spending a lot of time at the doctors, they're having to go back and forth, it cuts into their time, it cuts into their work time. 25% of people who had been asked out of the sort of 14 million people living with chronic pain said that their pain had kept them from their usual activities, including their jobs and day-to-day life, for at least 14 days out of 3 months. So that's 2 weeks out of 3 months that they felt like they've been unable to get on with their day-to-day lives.
That's a lot of time. And when you consider taking 14 days off work, I don't, like, each individual job is different, but for example, paid sick leave, it's not a part of everybody's contract. And if you've got people who are dependent on you, it can also then go on to affect their lives.
This is something, 41% of people who have attended pain clinics said that their pain had prevented them from working at a certain point. And then also 13% had actually had to reduce the hours of work.
And also, actually, if you're in a lot of pain, despite, no matter the determination you may have to get into work, it can also affect your job performance, which could potentially affect in the future employers looking at you and considering you for something like promotions, for example. Or there is still a stigma attached to this idea of chronic pain and chronic illnesses.
And there's also, I think, this image that if you have this, it's like, oh, look at this heroic person who's got on with their life and they're doing fine, why aren't you doing fine? And you've got to take a step back and kind of think, like, this person is going through a hell. I don't think anyone has the right to say you have to be doing this. And it was something like in the 2008 Chief Medical Officer report, it stated that 25% of pain sufferers lose their jobs, which is a quarter of people who are suffering with this out of some 14 million or something like that. And then 16% of sufferers say that the pain is so bad that they sometimes want to die. And this is just, I think it goes on to show the massive social and economic implications.
And not just economic, but also mental health and emotional well-being, as well as physical well-being,
which is something that Harry goes on to talk about.
Yeah, so I had this appointment scheduled for August 31st, but my parents were just kind of watching me slowly fall apart, really. I wasn't able to do anything in the day. I'd literally wake up, have breakfast, then go back to sleep again, because even just the act of eating would cause me incredible pain and also fatigue. Meanwhile, I was meant to be having, you know, what was the summer of my 21st, and I wasn't able to see any of my friends do anything, and it sucked being cooped up in the house. But at the same time, I didn't really notice what I was missing out, because what I was going through was just kind of occupying all my time and my kind of mental focus. And so my parents decided, right, we're going to take you to A&E because, you know, let's try and get something done for you. And so my dad drove me, and we waited for about 4 or 5 hours in this hospital. And for me, that's actually not too bad, because the pain wasn't massively prevalent at that point. But it just kind of shows that what I was dealing with wasn't really what the A&E were meant to deal with. And so by the time that I got seen, got a blood test taken, I think they were confused why I wasn't just being treated at my specialist in Nottingham. And because of the way the NHS works, you don't always have access to the information that Nottingham has, and the places in London won't be able to access the information. And so, you know, also there's a reason why they send you to a specialist, because the specialist knows how to deal with the condition, whereas your just average nurse or doctor might not have the necessary specialization. And so, yeah, by the time I got seen, they just gave me like six steroids to take home. And, you know, that basically is like a course that I'd normally take in a day. And so clearly it's not enough for something that's been going on for however many weeks it was, maybe three or four at that time, probably a bit more actually. And so I went home, and at this point I was fed up of doctors. I was, you know, I just couldn't be bothered at this point. And so when finally we actually managed to push the August appointment a little bit earlier to like the 28th or 29th or something, my dad drove me up again, and we sat down in front of her, and I was just so like unresponsive. I just couldn't care less. I was just convinced it would either pass or I would just kind of continue going down this pretty horrible road. The doctor as well, I don't really know what she was thinking. I like to think that her prescription that she gave me was based on the fact that I'd already had two courses of steroids, and the side effects of steroids, like I said earlier, were pretty severe. They can also result in stuff like bone thinning, and, you know, things that are actually long-term problems rather than just like affect you in the immediacy of it. So she just gave me these tablets to take that were just meant to slightly boost something in my blood levels. And I was just really confused, because I thought, why don't they just give me the steroids? Like, that's the only thing that will have an immediate help. Or, like, you know, at least, you know, that's another thing. Why didn't the A&E just, you know, put me up in one of their beds rather than sending me away thinking that I'd get better? And so we went home again, and my parents, meanwhile, were, like, trying to give me, like, a special diet that my mum had Googled online and was convinced would help me, but... Yeah, and there are points where diet can help with my condition, but like, I was so far gone at that point, nothing was going to help. And you know, the tablets, all I was doing was taking them, but like, they weren't designed to combat any of my symptoms, I don't think. And so yeah, my dad was like, let's go to A&E again. And yeah, I normally don't argue with my dad, but I really, like, even though I was so tired and so like just not really with it, I actually like properly had a go at him. Well, I didn't have a go at him. I was basically just venting my frustrations with my experience with doctors and how they'd never really been able to help me, at him. And I was so convinced that even if we went, they would just turn us away, or we'd queue for 5 hours and get the same kind of just, you know, here, take some pills, you know, we can't deal with you, go away. And my dad basically had to like force me in the car, and drove off to a different A&E this time. And thank God they saw that I, you know, what condition I was in, and they basically immediately started processing me into their system to get me onto like one of the beds and stuff like that, and started outlining like a treatment plan. And yeah, it was my first experience of being in a hospital, like full-on, not just kind of, you know, getting my bloods taken or, you know, seeing a doctor, actually kind of living there. And my first night was pretty scary. At this point as well, my weight had dropped to about 41 kilograms from where I was about 50 or 51 at the start of the summer. As well, my hemoglobin count was about 75, and your hemoglobins help carry oxygen through your blood, and so, you know, basically kind of power your muscles, and so I wasn't able really to do much as well. And I felt really helpless. My parents had left. I was just surrounded by these other six guys who all sounded in incredible amounts of pain as well. I didn't know any of them. The nurses were really nice, but, you know, it got to a point where about 2 a.m. and this guy in the bed opposite me was like really just, he was just screaming for a nurse really. And I it was kind of quite, you know, like scary again, because you've just got this guy like shouting and screaming opposite you, and like the curtains are all drawn, so you don't really know what's going on. And basically he had a flight that was meant to get on the next day, but he also had surgery scheduled for the morning, but he wasn't allowed to eat between certain times, from about like 2 a.m. to I think like, I can't remember, 4 a.m. or something. And by the time that he was allowed to eat, all the kitchens had closed, so the most they could get him was like crisps. And you know, he hadn't eaten for literally like quite a couple of days apparently, something like that, because of what he was or was not allowed to eat. And so I offered him some food that my parents had brought with me to just try and, like, I know what they were thinking, I wasn't even able to eat any of it, but I offered him and he said, you know, thanks, but I'm just gonna have what they give me.
Something that I think is really interesting to consider after listening to Harry there, the fact that actually the way the health system works often doesn't, it fails slightly for people our age who are at university, because they're switching between GPs for over the summer can be quite difficult, and actually a lot of your confidential information isn't shared to places like A&E, and it can mean getting the right treatment can be quite difficult.
This is one thing that no one sees what you're going through. No one saw Harry being, I mean, I'm sure people did see Harry being ill, but day to day, he wasn't the kid who everyone was like, oh my God, we have to help. He was someone who just looked.
It's not always apparent straight away. It's not always apparent immediately that there's.
And the issue with that is that you go to the doctors and you don't necessarily look like you're in a great amount of pain and you're really struggling. And when you don't have that communication between doctors, there's no way for your GP that you're going to in Nottingham to know that how much you've been struggling previously, even if you tell them. They've not been there with you through the whole thing.
And I think it meant that obviously Harry then had to travel a lot between where he was living in London and Nottingham to get something to seek the right medical care.
Yeah, something he said to us was about the fact that his dad had to take on a lot of the role of sort of ferrying him about, taking him to different specialists and stuff like that, and his dad was able to do that, but it's difficult, isn't it? It kind of leads on to this kind of thing that we were talking about dependence and stuff like that.
And kind of almost a loss of independence.
Yeah, a loss of autonomy even.
Yeah, and I feel like that can kind of increase frustrations, because it makes you feel less in control of the entire situation, even more.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something that Harry expresses like frustration with, is this idea that he, you know, it was the summer of his 21st birthday, he was an adult, he had all of this stuff that he wanted to do, and he was unable to do the things that he wanted to do while he was young, because he had to kind of almost regress into this state where he was dependent on his parents again. It was a moment of feeling almost, I guess, childlike, I don't know.
And I think as well, like, it's really clear from what Harry was saying that there was a lot of frustration with A&E itself, mm-hmm. and partly because of the fact that, again, there's this lack of communication between A&E doctors and them being unable to access confidential information that your GP will have about your existing conditions, and about how even though they'd had a conversation about this condition that Harry has, and obviously, like, it was obvious that he was in a lot of pain, yet it was, she still didn't prescribe a treatment plan that was successful in alleviating a lot of pain. And I think as well, towards the end of what Harry was saying there, was that I think it kind of showed that actually going back into hospital and things like that, it did have an effect on perhaps his mental health and his emotional well-being.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
He was going for surgery about 7 a.m. and I hadn't been able to sleep like a wink. And suddenly the curtains like opened, and he was being wheeled past in the bed. He basically said like, oh, hey, thanks for offering me the food last night. It was like, they told me what you had and that really sucks, and I hope they are able to help you. And I just remember at that point, like, suddenly the only thing that someone had said to me all summer that actually made me feel better, but it also at the same time made me realize the state that I was really in, and I just kind of started crying, and all the curtains were drawn up again at this point, and I was trying to like muffle the sound and my whole body was just like racking. Yeah, you know, like I hadn't cried in years. And for some reason, I just wasn't able to stop at that point. And then obviously the nurses came in like an hour or so later to give me breakfast and whatever. And I just kind of, you know, wiped my eyes and stuff and tried to get on with what was happening. But I think it kind of just showed the state that I was really in, that kind of also my mental state at that point of what I was dealing with and maybe how unprepared I was to deal with it. But yeah, I still think it's really the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me, just as a stranger, and meant it, I think. And also, like, the fact that he was still in so much pain as well and that was going through this scary surgery and had time to say that to me was really, yeah, it was quite moving and also, I guess, affirming in a way. And then I got moved to a different ward after my treatment was going a little bit better. And the guys there were all in the same kind of boat as me, but most of them were a lot older. And one guy had like some kind of night terrors or something and would just scream like most of the night. And like when you're going to the toilet and suddenly this guy just like wakes up and shouts at you, it's like really terrifying. I also had what looks like some kind of Frankenstein like creation going on, because they were basically pumping what looks like treacle into my arm from this massive drip that was like this bulging bag. And yeah, I'd just sit there all day, and I must have read the books I brought with me twice. They're both Bill Bryson books. I could probably like recount sections right now, but I was still fairly immobile in a lot of pain. But kind of what really got me through it was the nurses, who were so nice and would spend like time talking to me if they had it, and also the visits from my friends, who I basically had to tell at this point what was going on, because I was meant to be in Nottingham by September the 10th, and it was now September the 15th that I hadn't showed. And that was pretty scary telling them, but I knew they were going to respond in a way that was full of like concern and care. And it was so touching that they took the time to come down from Nottingham or come up from wherever to come and visit me. But I knew that seeing me would be a little bit scary for them, so I tried to like hold it off. But some people were just, you know, very nice. You were like, oh no, I want to see you right now, or you know, we'd only be able to take trains down at some point. And my friend in particular, she saw me when I was definitely like the treatment hadn't started working by then at all, so I was really looking quite bad and pale and kind of skeleton like. And yeah, she told me like on the way back, she was like crying because of the state that I was in. And again, it just kind of shows that I would normalize certain behavior or symptoms.
I think something that we want to touch on for this section of Harry's speech about what he went through is this idea of the impact of mental health, which is something that we have kind of touched on, but it's,
we've not really gone into a massive amount of detail yet.
Yeah, and I think something that is often overlooked is the impact that physical health has on your mental health, and in turn the impact that your mental health has on your physical health and your ability to do things. And it's not just physical pain that prevented Harry and prevents people who suffer from chronic illnesses from doing things. It's
also, to some extent, I guess, also their emotional well-being or their mental health.
Yeah, which when you feel hopeless.
Yeah.
And I read a really interesting statistic that I think came from the National Institute of Mental Health that said depression is actually approximately 2 to 3 times more common in patients with a chronic physical health condition than people who have good health, and occurs in about 20% of people with a chronic physical health condition, which is, you know, massive.
It's a massive, massive.
And to be honest, I would go on to suggest that it's a lot higher than that, because obviously with diagnosis of mental health issues and the people who come forward and stuff, it's often very hard to sort of
kind of approximate.
Yeah, but equally, people with mental health difficulties are more likely to suffer from chronic illnesses because they have a harder time caring for their health, seeking care for themselves, taking medication, eating well, exercising. So these all come in and they all kind of combine together to create what I think is a very difficult situation mental health wise. And there's these
feelings of vulnerability.
And I think as well, with vulnerability, often people don't want to come across as vulnerable. I know I personally don't. And so sometimes I feel like it can be quite difficult. Like when Harry was talking about him crying in the hospital, but kind of not really wanting
anyone to know about
people
it.
To yeah. know. And also I think like that was obviously like a really hard point in what Harry's been talking to us about, because obviously like I think that was definitely a low in how he was feeling. He didn't,
that was a time when I think he felt very hopeless, and that's something that comes across. But what he does touch on, which I think is very
important to like kind of talk about as
yeah
well,
is kind of almost a moment of moments of lightness within this period that he was struggling. He found solidarity with this specific man who was going through, I mean, it sounds like he was going through hell and Harry was going through hell, but there was this moment where they were both like, I want you to feel better and I want me to feel better, and I, you know, there's so much pain, but there's still this kind of sense of empathy.
And Harry was telling us that this conversation he had with this stranger that he met in the hospital, he was also kind of going through a tough time at the same time. He said it was the most sincere thing somebody had said to him since he'd been in the hospital.
And, you know, I don't want to be like, oh, it's all right because you make great friends out of it. Like, that's, but at the same time, I think Harry has said that he experienced quite a lot of kindness. He spoke about his friends who came to visit him. He spoke about the nurses, the other patients he was around. And I think there is this sense, especially with Harry, that he did try and sort of look for the light throughout of all of the impact that it must have had on his mental health.
Yeah, so I think the main thing that I was struggling with and throughout the whole condition was the courage, I guess, to tell my friends what was going on. And even though I knew they would respond in the way I would imagine they would, I still thought it's like, it sounds weird, but you let them know that you're weaker than they think you are, that you're not 100% okay, and you're never really going to be 100% okay. And for some of them, that responded in treating you with kind of, you know, gloves on a lot of the time. And it's nice, obviously, that they're concerned, but you do want to be treated like other people, you know, and just not them, have them think about it. And most of them, you know, arguably don't think about it, and that's fine. And often when they do extend, you know, oh, would you like, you know, a lift in the car today rather than walking into uni, that is a really nice offer. But I normally don't take it because I'm feeling tired. I normally take it because, you know, I can't be bothered to get the bus or walk. I think the point that I'm trying to get at is that the act of telling someone just means that the perception that you think and want them to have of you is kind of irrevocably changed, and you can't really get around that. And you, I think you like to imagine that people regard you in a certain way, when actually probably their kind of complete picture of you is a little bit different to what we think. But definitely, you know, you don't really have much control over what they get from that information and how they choose to perceive you after. By about the 20th of September, I was just completely going mad in that hospital. I was cooped up. I didn't have my laptop. My phone, like, was just, like, dodgy internet. And, yeah, like I said, I'd, you know, my friends, like, bought me books and stuff like that. It was really nice. But you can only do so much reading in a day or staring at the wall. I couldn't move around much. And then one time, I made the stupid decision of thinking, there's a subway at the bottom of Charing Cross Hospital. I'm going to go get the lift down, have like a cookie, and then just go back up. And then, you know, I was allowed to have a cookie or something. But then the lifts in Charing Cross are really like slow and don't take that long. So I thought, you know what? I can just walk up the stairs back to my ward. I then tried 6 flights of stairs and nearly collapsed at the top. Basically hauled myself into the bed, like slept for like 3 hours, and then like vowed never again to walk out anywhere in life. And yeah, you know, that was the thing, full of this, I make really stupid decisions. So although I do have a moan about doctors and stuff, you know, I think part of it, and I think though, you know, you see it with like old people especially, is that they think their capacity for stuff is greater than it actually is, when actually you should allow yourself to be not like pampered, but, you know, taken care of occasionally. And I think I've always been fairly independent in stuff that I do, and having that taken away from me, or kind of having that ability to rely on myself to do things like walk up a flight of stairs was really quite, had an impact on me. By the 22nd of September, they were allowing me to go, but the doctors kind of sat me down before I left and told me a couple of things. They said I needed 2 weeks rest at home, and for me, when I had a project that I was meant to have been running for the last 2 weeks but hadn't been able to because I was in hospital, and I knew that it was actually airing on the Friday and this was the Tuesday I was being let out, I decided that not to tell my parents that the doctors said I should rest at home for 2 weeks and instead go back to uni. This was a huge mistake, really. They also told me it might even be worth deferring my MA for a year and focus on getting healthy, because like I said, I'd lost a lot of weight. It would take quite a while to put back on weight. It's harder to put on a big amount of weight than it is to lose it. I again thought, nah. And then they were like, okay, if that's the case, you're going to do these infusion sessions with the doctors in Nottingham every so often, and also try not to put yourself under too much stress, because the disease is stress related and it can like flare up occasionally. And again, something that I quickly disregarded. So I went back to uni and I kind of thought, hey, I've been resting up in hospital this time, like I'm gonna have loads of energy, you know. I keep on thinking I want to get out, and then I quickly realized that my body was not up to what I usually think it's up to, in that I could barely walk 15 minutes without being massively drained. I was meant to be talking to people about URN at the Freshers' Fair from about 9 till 5 for 2 days straight. I then had the new members meeting the next week. I was meant to be going out with people. And all of this I was trying to manage while also having, like, just my legs feel like they weren't working. A couple of things we put in process, though, to help that, so it wasn't too bad. And I started this kind of really quite intense diet, to the point where I'd actually regained quite a bit of my weight by November, but had also bankrupted myself, because you can't like order 12 Krispy Kremes a day, eat them for 5 days straight.
Harry focuses here a lot on sort of talking about telling friends and family about what he's going through and the way that he kind of dealt with the situation, which in
at
some
times
respects was maybe characteristically of Harry to kind of just be like, no, I'm going to continue with my life and it will be fine.
I feel like it shows a lot of determination to carry on with things even when you're feeling really rubbish.
And I think it, you know, he said to us, oh, obviously, like, it was stupid, it was foolhardy and all of that kind of thing, but I think on a certain level it's very understandable that you know, you want to be able to walk downstairs, go and buy a Subway cookie and then walk back upstairs, and for that not to be some kind of massive feat where you have to crawl into bed afterwards. I think that's almost part of the human condition, is just you don't want to have that vulnerability.
It perhaps wasn't, like, considering Harry's health at the time, perhaps trying to, like, 6 flights of stairs might not have been the first kind of thing that he should have aimed to do.
But yeah, perhaps, I do think it's, like, quite a natural thing. I just want to do things that other people can do.
No, I completely agree.
And I think that's probably the most frustrating thing in some respects, is just, you know, Harry talks a lot about the fact that he didn't want people to treat him like he was made of glass or whatever. And in some respects, they probably needed to, because he wasn't well. But I think it just, the frustration is very evident in what he's saying.
Yeah, and I can understand that you wouldn't want people to treat you differently. I feel like nobody wants to be defined by something like such as like an invisible illness. Nobody wants to be known like that. And I don't think just because somebody is treating you differently, perhaps looking after you a little bit more, I don't think that that's necessarily what it means. But I feel like sometimes that's what it might feel like.
I think also the fact that it's an invisible illness, you know, as much as Harry was talking earlier about the fact that he was, you know, he looked quite skeletal, he was very pale, he wasn't, you know, it didn't have these physical symptoms that make it almost make people more accepting of this illness. It's something that's just all contained within your own body. And I think there's probably a sense of disconnect when you look in the mirror and you don't see someone who's, you know.
Arguably, at that point, though, perhaps Harry's condition it became more visible to a certain extent. Like when Harry was talking about when his friends came to visit him, they'd not seen him in a while, and the change, like the visible change, was obviously very shocking for them. And perhaps this is like one of the only times that Harry's condition has actually been visible to other people, rather than, I mean, to some extent it is obviously still, and it's always going to be an invisible illness, but perhaps that's one of the only times that it will have been visible.
Also, with Harry talking about being in a hospital setting, like you're saying about how it becomes more visible, maybe
the hospital setting also has a hand in making the illness more visible.
There's something
example,
about
like having a drip in your arm.
Yeah, I think there's something about being in hospital for a long period of time. I know when I've been in hospital for a long period of time, it starts to feel like this kind of like liminal phase in your life where it just feels like it's just not real. And I think when you're there and you're so unwell and you're in hospital day in, day out, it's very difficult for your illness not to become your identity, especially when you're in such pain and stuff like that. And Harry talks about sitting there with like this drip in his arm that looked like, I think he says treacle or something like that.
I don't know. For me, I feel like that would be quite a scary experience, because obviously like it's a bit of a foreign substance. Like it's not something that you would think of as like a natural colour to be injecting into yourself.
Into your body, yeah. Being all wired up to a bed and stuff like that.
I think also though, Harry touches on the way that he kind of, although at times he perhaps stretched himself too far and kind of had unrealistic goals for himself physically, he also did do a lot of things to help him cope. For example, the decision to continue with university this year, mm-hmm. He kind of acknowledged that it was going to be at times challenging, and so made the decision that because he wanted to continue with his leadership role within URN, that he would have to take steps to kind of help himself. Mm-hmm. And one of those was setting up kind of a deputy to his position within University Radio. Mm. And I think that it shows
an element of facilitation for illnesses, I think, that we're kind of maybe developing a little bit more. And it's not a case of, well, if you're ill, you know, you can't take on leadership positions, you can't do this, you can't do that. There's a sense that maybe
There's ways round things. Like, I think it shows that even though Harry is now living with an invisible illness in this condition, it's not going to stop him from doing things.
I mean, equally, Harry had to set that up himself, and he had to sort that out himself, and it's a testament that he was able to do that. And I think probably a lot of people in the same position maybe wouldn't have been able to do something like that, so maybe it is something that there needs to be more channels of communication and stuff like that.
I think it definitely shows a lot of perseverance and determination.
And it has allowed me to connect with people I probably wouldn't normally. The people at the hostel aren't like, you know, students. They're not people from London. And they all have gone through a similar thing that I have. And it's really nice to talk to them and also realise that a lot of them had it way worse than you. You know, one guy went on the path that I was going on in 2017 summer, but went way worse and ended up in a coma. And, you know, it's kind of puts you in perspective. And also another guy was dealing with epilepsy as well as this condition. You just kind of think, wow, you know, it's hard enough managing this condition. This guy, if he has another epileptic fit, has to, you know, not drive for 2 years. I think, you know, now it's kind of okay. I go to the infusion sessions. I don't have to take as many pills. I'm able to enjoy my life to kind of where it was before the disease, just with the kind of added knowledge of to keep an eye out for my symptoms, make sure I take my pills every day, and hopefully the therapy, the immunotherapy that I'm on now will kind of actually really help. And it's, I think that's the worry, is that it might be that now my condition is just kind of dormant and it will just flare up again like it did last summer, even though I was on medication for it. Or, you know, hopefully I've now kind of put it to bed for good and I will be able to mostly live a kind of normal life, because I was meant to be starting a temp job in the summer of 2017 to, you know, finance my masters, and I couldn't because I couldn't even, you know, shave or shower. You know, like I said, that's why I ran out of money, because I couldn't really finance what I was doing. And I think all in all, though, the disease has taught me to appreciate what I have. It sounds pretty cliched and, you know, corny, but you do realise that you have a family who really wants to help you and cares about you. You have friends who will take time out of, you know, their busy schedules to come and visit you and check that you're okay. You know, yeah, you know, although I have moaned about doctors and the NHS, the nurses were so nice to me. Makes you realise how they really do come from all walks of life and all places over the world, with a passion and a really strong dedication to caring. You know, I was quite a quiet, I think, nice patient, but some of the people I was with would, you know, throw stuff at them, shout at them if they got their breakfast order wrong, you know, and they'd have to deal with pretty grim conditions as well, with people with, you know, worse conditions than mine as well. And still do it with a smile on their face and want to ask you about, you know, your life. And I think that was definitely really inspiring. There was that one guy who I talked about who actually made me feel better about the place I was in. I think generally in how it's treated when I bring it up with people, they look at the kind of, you know, 5 Krispy Kremes a day or whatever I was talking about earlier, and they think, oh, you know, wish I had that condition. And it's like, no, you don't. You really don't. You may think you do, but the cost of what I've had to do in order to have to go through that diet definitely is not something I want to do. The fact that as well that's been sapping at me for years without me realizing it means that, you know, maybe I'm not ever really going to be 100% healthy. And that's kind of weird to think about. You know, you like to think at different times in your life, oh yeah, I was healthy then, you know, I got, you know, that then, but you know, I went back to being healthy after. And I've definitely seen more of the inside of a hospital than I should or would want to at 21, but hopefully in the next 6 months I can kind of look at my progress and think I'm on a better, you know, I'm better than I was last year, and that's the main thing. And you know, ultimately everyone has something in their lives where if I heard it, I'd probably have a similar reaction of being like, yeah, how did you cope with that? That's awful. And so although mine has its particular kind of quirks or problems, it's definitely not the worst out there. And it kind of looks worse on paper when I say it. And although it was bad at times, you know, generally I do manage okay.
At the beginning of that clip, Harry mentioned about the financial strain his condition had had on his university life, because obviously being sick had meant that he couldn't work over the summer, and that then this had then had an impact on how he was going to fund his master's. And I just think that that kind of demonstrates how invisible illnesses can impact a variety of areas of your life.
Yeah, definitely. I think Harry does try and kind of end it on like quite a positive note, and he's like quite sort of like wants to look towards the future. But I don't think that you can ignore the kind of burden that it's had over the last 2 years and the kind of effect that it's had on him. And I think he does kind of, you know, it's an attitude that you can have that like everyone has their problems, blah, 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 blah. And it's not wrong.
But it also kind of plays down perhaps the kind of maybe
there's something
struggle.
That a lot of people with invisible illnesses, especially I think there's a thing with like mental illnesses especially, that people are always like, well, I don't want to seek out treatment because there's someone who's got it worse than me. And I think that's something that, you know, you have to be aware of and you kind of have to be careful with, is that anyone who is struggling with any kind of condition or just doesn't feel like they're feeling like they should, it's important and it's okay to want to get better and to want to seek out treatment.
Yeah, I do think at the end of when we were talking to Harry, by the end of it, he did kind of seem almost become slightly more accepting, perhaps, of his condition.
And I think with something that's lifelong condition, as so many chronic conditions are,
that's a difficult point perhaps to get to.
That's a point that I think it does take a while to get used to, is this idea that this is your life now and this is what you have to deal with for the foreseeable future. And I don't think there's any way that anyone who's gone through that, no one can tell you when you have to accept that that's your life or that you even have to. I don't think it's an easy thing to do. And it's it's nice to want to round it off into like a perfect little conclusion where you're like, oh, you know, this is life, I'm okay, I'm moving on with it. But
at the same time,
yeah,
I do think that
it's just not easy. It's for want of a better way to tie up this discussion, it's hard.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. We've titled this podcast, But You Don't Look Sick. What does this phrase mean to you?
I think although no one's ever said it, I've definitely felt it you know, I felt that I shouldn't complain because I don't look sick. I felt that people shouldn't pity me because I don't look sick. And while I don't think I actively go after people's pity, you know, sometimes you do need sympathy and help and support from people. And I think sometimes I've turned that down because I feel like there's almost a pressure on me not to display, you know, that kind of vulnerability that accompanies being ill. And so, yeah, that's what, you know, you don't look sick means to me.
Tune in to our next episode as we continue our exploration into invisible illness. You can find us on URN's Facebook page, Audio Boom, and Mixcloud.
Each week, we ask the people that feature on this podcast to give a word that they feel best sums up their experience.
Harry's going to start us off.
Courage.